Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Joe Donahue. Okay, so we're going to have a conversation about sex, and we're going to be talking about that for our next segment. Now, this isn't an overly graphic conversation, but we are going to be talking about liberation and intimacy and communication. And if that is a topic that you are not interested in or would prefer that those around you not hear, we're giving you a warning, and you can come back to us in about 15 minutes, and it will be over. So to have this discussion about sex, we go to Dr. Candace Nicole Hargens, an award-winning psychologist and associate professor at the Rollins School of Public Health at Emory University, where she studies sexual wellness and liberation. As a leading expert in sex research, she joins us this morning to discuss her new book, Good Sex: Stories, Science, and Strategies for Sexual Liberation. Good sex encourages intimacy, fun, pleasure, and connection. It also outlines steps to understand, define, and practice sexual liberation in your personalized way. Again, the name of the book is Good Sex, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Dr. Candace Nicole Hargens to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let me just immediately go to the term sexual liberation. What is that for those of us who may know what it is or what it means in this context?
Yeah, I think that it's an evolving definition. I think some of the folks who are listening who came up in the 60s and 70s have an idea of the free love movement. I think that was one of the more recent times where people were talking about sexual liberation. But in this context, I mean sex that is good to and good for everyone involved. And that means we should all have access to the ingredients that make sex good according to your own definition of it.
When you look at this and as you've studied this, where are we now? I mean, in the sense of, has this evolved or is this always changing and going up and down, as it were?
It's going up and down. And what we find is there are moments in society where we experience a tendency towards sexual liberation. And then we have moments in society that I call silent hypocrisy, where our behaviors are still trending towards sexual liberation, but the things we say about it vocally and externally get more limited or constrained based on social approval.
So social approval, but what brings that out? What brings the hypocrisy to the fore?
I think people honestly are afraid that in times that may be perceived as more regressive or more puritanical or traditional, that they would be negatively judged if people knew what they were doing. And so instead of changing behaviors, which most humans are going to do the things that feel good and feel right for them, they just stop talking about it, stop having transparent, authentic, and vulnerable conversations about what they really like, what they really want, and what they can really bring to a sexual experience.
The old adage, going back, and I'm 57, so like my parents' time, was the things you don't talk about are religion, politics, and sex at the dining room table. And a lot of that's been blown out of the water, but we're still, as Americans, not great about talking about sex, are we?
No, we're really not. And I think what gets in the way of our ability to talk about it is like these three levels of fear. So we fear that we will be perceived as inadequate or somehow not good enough if we talk about sex. We might be transgressing those ideas of taboo, but we also fear talking to our partners about it, the people we're actually having sex with, because we don't want to hurt their feelings or their ego. And sometimes people fear that they shouldn't have to talk about sex if they're in a relationship. So those relationship level fears, like, you should already know. And I think we miss the mark in that expectation.
I realize that this is probably a sliding scale and is not, you know, not one size fits all, as it were, but that it depends on when you have those conversations with your partner, right? I mean,
yes,
it can be at the beginning. It can be as the relationship evolves. It can be a reset, right? There are other opportunities.
It needs to be all of those time points. And thank you for sharing that, because it's not just a we met, we decided we want to be together, we have one conversation and things go well. Like, as you evolve with your partner, as you grow together or grow apart in some ways, you want to have those ongoing conversations about sex and about the relationship overall, sex being a part of it, that help you better understand each other, because none of us stays the same.
When it is that idea of none of us stay the same, so it's changing for all of us, and how do you recommend, and what do you see from your research and people that you've talked to on this, the best way to approach how you have changed and you would like the sexual relationship to change?
I have two suggestions on that. The first one is to make it meta. So I think our meta communication is one of our biggest tells and also our biggest opportunities when it comes to talking about sex. If you feel awkward, if you know that it's a conversation that makes you feel anxious or makes your partner feel anxious, name that. So they're going to probably see it on your face or see it in your body language. Acknowledge that. And I think that normalizes that. Most of us weren't really well trained or educated in sex, and it's okay to not know, and it's okay to grow. And the second part of it is lead with what you want as opposed to what you don't want. A lot of times when I'm working with couples as a psychologist, they come to me with a framing of this is what's not working anymore. This is what is not so great. And they have a harder time envisioning what they want it to be. And so knowing what you want it to be and leading with that in the conversation can really make it an open, more positive experience as opposed to shaming someone or blaming someone for it not being as good as it could be.
Why aren't we better at education and sex education in our schools?
I think a time such as this lets us know that people get very prickly around having comprehensive sex ed taught K through 12. And I think it should be taught in developmentally appropriate ways across the human lifespan. But a lot of people feel like, I don't want other people talking to my kids about sex. Meanwhile, they're not talking to their kids about sex, or they don't want value incongruent information being shared with their kids. But I believe it needs to be evidence and scientifically grounded, medically accurate and positive. And so if we, as people in the United States, could get better about that, releasing some of those taboos, I know for sure that in states where that's occurring, we see better sexual health outcomes.
I just think back to my education in 13 years, including kindergarten, and over that time, 2 days spent on the subject of sex.
Yes.
And of those 2 days, it was only about a 40-minute conversation. So it's not something that is in-depth, certainly.
Did you have the boys in one room, girls in another room version that I had?
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And that seems silly.
And
although I will say in high school, I had a very good health teacher who taught sex ed and was extremely good at telling us about different, using modern vernacular and telling us, you know, things that we were hearing on TV and how it was sexualized. And I remember that making a real difference.
To that health teacher. Okay, give me what state was this?
Because this is Pennsylvania, and her name was Candace, and I also like your name. But I don't remember. I don't remember her last name. Yeah,
I love that. Thanks for sharing.
So let me ask the question about so when it comes to education now, and with that being stymied by many in school boards and school districts across the country. And on top of that, just gender, the issues of gender and also sexual preference. I mean, these are all things that are sort of adding to being ostracized and I guess ultimately making it even harder to have honest conversations with your partner and someone that you want to be with.
Yeah, they are. And not being able to have honest conversations about the variety of human sexual experiences and preferences then makes people feel ashamed. And that shame really gets in the way when you're in a consensual, healthy relationship and want to experience sex, but you don't know what's okay to say or whether you're okay as a person.
How has porn screwed things up?
You know what? I think that it's entertainment and it's not being taken as entertainment. And that is how it screwed things up. It gives you this fantastical version of what sex should be. And for people who are watching it who are underage, they don't know that it's entertainment. And sometimes for people who are of age, they forget that their bodies aren't supposed to look perfect, that they're not supposed to look and sound and be a certain way. So for people of all genders, I think if they're buying into what porn represents as like a staple of sex, as opposed to this is like the WWE of sex, they probably have a misguided idea of who they're supposed to be as a sexual being.
When I was growing up, and I assume the same with you, it was very difficult. Not that we didn't try as kids, but it was very difficult to come across pornography, where now it's the easiest thing in the world.
We tried for sure.
Yeah, you try. but now it's so available and quite frankly easy to hide from your parents or guardians. So what exactly is the responsibility, do you think, of us as a society and us as parents and guardians to make sure that what kids and others are taking in is moderated and at least put into a context?
Yes, I think if we start with the idea that we know it's out there and that we would like them not to use it, but we understand that we can't control them every single moment, we would name, these are the things that it can do, these are the things that it cannot do, and I want you to understand. So it's basically porn literacy. It's like, I want you to understand that this is fiction, this is entertainment. I would prefer you not use it, watch it, because a lot of times when you're younger, it's hard to separate entertainment from real life. But here are some of the ways that, you know, people might be misrepresented, just so you'll know it when you see it, if you see it. Having those honest conversations can make a difference with kids because they're doing a lot of hiding and parents are doing a lot of avoiding.
Yes. I was taken by the material on the book of the book encourages intimacy, fun, pleasure, and connection. It seems like we forget the fun part sometimes.
Yes, we really do. And I think the way I frame it in that chapter on fun is that there are different types of fun one can have. So you can have, I call it thrill fun or chill fun. And understanding what is fun to each person makes us not take ourselves so seriously, especially, and I give this example because it's one that I think resonates with a lot of people in my age group. Like if you might experience infertility or some sexual complications or dysfunctions, we begin to make it so serious that it feels like pressure for everybody involved instead of an enjoyable, fun experience.
And that adds to the intimacy if it's fun.
Yes, it sure can.
When you look at your job, and I mentioned associate professor at the Rollins School of Public Health at Emory, how have things changed? Have you seen just a huge change in what you study and what you look at, or are we still dealing with issues and things that have been around for decades?
I think that we're becoming more innovative in how we intervene, which I'm excited about. I think that there are researchers now who are studying sex not just from a health deficit lens, like how to avoid disease and how to prevent certain things, but also how to get to optimal sexual functioning, optimal sexual health. And so those are some of the shifts that I've seen in the past 10 years. But I also would say we have a ways to go because they're not yet scaled in these interventions. And so you see pockets of studies with a few hundred people here, a few hundred people there, but translating what we find into policy, into practices and programs that are more widespread is our next step. And I think that will make a difference.
Final question. When you're talking to people, can you still get shocked?
You know, know, it's been a very long time since I was shocked. It has been a very, very long time. And I love talking about sex. So it takes a lot to shock me. But I'm always encouraged when people shock me because it means I have more to learn. And that's fun to me.
That's very funny. Well, the name of the book is Good Sex, Stories, Science, and Strategies for Sexual Liberation. The book is now out and published by Row House. Dr. Hargens, I thank you very much for spending time with us. It's a great pleasure to have you on the program. Be well.
Thank you so much. Take good care.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Again, the name of the book is Good Sex. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.